All right, everybody, we're going to get started. So we have an exciting afternoon for you, planned, including exciting conversations, video clips. We have a documentary that we're screening for the first time since day two. We have a documentarian in the house, Gary Millen. Hi, he will answer questions about the documentary. I'm screening. So we're going to present our experience in Uganda last August. My wife, Alita Dent, Dean of Libraries here at LIU. And Eric Yellen, second year student in the doctoral program here at LIU. We went to Uganda in August, and we were studying the effectiveness of a storytelling, story acting activity on preschool children's school readiness skills in a rural Ugandan community library. Yes, let me introduce the team to you. The American team, actually all four members of the American team are here today. We have myself, Jeff Goodman, Alita Dent, Eric Yellen, and Chantel Walker. Where is Chantel? Chantel, would you stand for us? We know Chantel. She's a social worker by training, but she also works in a managerial position in the Department of Labor. And so her boss's boss happens to be POTUS, President of the United States. Right there. So we're going to start off with the documentary. It's about 15 minutes in length. And this documentary was created by Eric Yellen. Did all the footage in the documentary, all the subtitles, everything. It's all Eric all the time. And we're very grateful to the Department of Performing Arts here at Long Island University for lending us a $4,000 video camera so that we can take some very beautiful footage of our experience in Uganda last August. So, without further ado, play the video tape.
We are in Uganda as a village, which is a I'm one in Sweden, and I'm here at Rwanda, Chitengesa, the Masaka district, is the central part of Uganda, and I'm working at the library, Chitengesa Public Library. I started sometime back in 1999 with just a box of books.
My name is Hay Perry. I'm a professor of Department of English at Hunter College, City University of New York. But I spend half of my time, or as near half of my time as I can make it, in Uganda, working on human studies. In the mid-1990s, I had a patient from Uganda, and the science of human research in the village where I was going to come up. In the course of research, I met the head teacher of the Chitengesa Complex Secondary School, and he said that his ambition was to set up a community library which would be within the school, but should serve a community beyond the school. That was a good idea, so I suggested he could start immediately, and I bought a box of books. And so he did
that. This is the way to do it. Then we try it there. Ten people live in this house. Then ten children, including me and my mother and my father, which total half of the room. We have just received the running water a couple of years ago, but we don't have electricity. And people are mainly depend on calculating, and the income of the people is low, it's not that big. with somebody who knows American
there.
No,
not understanding over there, because there wasn't much to share from the region. And we see the symbols. Lots of symbols.
So the schools here are also relatively poor. Yeah, you will find that in the whole school, for example, the Liberty Primary School, they have about like few textbooks with hundreds of kids running around. So now the popular Chinese are interested in intervening in bringing these children down to the library and accessing these reading materials.
So when did the library come into place? I was in the final, and I was in grade 7. And I was just starting up there and didn't know what was taking place over there yet. So I went to the library and asked Mr. Chan about the books that I can read. Of course, he gave me like traditional stories, fantasy books. I used to always borrow like a book every evening.
We work with the school and we work with these children. So we assess and we see like how they progress on reading, and we provide reading materials according to their needs.
We started with 160 books in
1999. We now have another 3,000 books to be covered with instant messages and video ones. And the familiar picture of what is happening around here, so they can just relate this to what is at home and what the children are going to do. Then as they graduate, they learn to be words and then sentences as they grow. This one, Recite for Disaster, then it talks about like, the life of like, young so people are eager to read about and see because they see the similarities between what is happening now and what is in the book. Yeah, and these are the books which are expensive, you rarely available in the schools. We have all the books like this one, I don't think that most schools here would find the channel. We receive the newspaper, so it's the only place where people come and access the national newspaper, they read what is happening, and the markets and all that.
There are people all over the country, in the house, in the room, I read books for the children, age 3 to 7 years. Okay. So I fetch the children from the schools, and I bring them to the library. So I read the book. After reading the book, I ask the children questions about the book, etc. I ask them questions, they answer. And I read once a week. I think the goal of this reading groups is getting the children to love reading books and putting the reading culture to the children. And they really like it.
So now we have 150 primary school children coming to the library every week. The secondary school also has scheduled them. So we've got this regular training program of children, school children. Like, and then many of those children come back and so I think that we can say that we can be pretty successful at encouraging
the impact of the library to the community. We've seen students who have been using the library improving in academic college, and this can be witnessed by the school where we started from. And the academic performance has been going up and up and up.
Yesterday I got news that would never happen again. Hiring was accepted to the University of Cambodia in industrial engineering.
has been a hub of international researchers.
So that the children also get the chance to enjoy this and benefit from it.
be treated as an ability to write down.
I think at the end of the day, our goal is really to promote development of a reading culture. And even though historically reading is something that's been associated with the West, we know that you can't separate reading from economic development. And so what we're trying to do on a micro scale is to develop models that we can then use in other rural community libraries in Uganda, in Kenya, Tanzania, Burkina Faso, Ghana, that will serve to promote the development of reading cultures in those villages. And hopefully just develop a love of reading, and that will translate into later success as they grow older and go out into the world.
There's a whole lot more research has been done, and it all contributes to the
Yeah, I think a lot of research has been really positive. Research resulted in like critical thinking of an individual person, how they benefit directly, and now there is an improvement of their businesses and their understanding of their well-being. In the future, we see as a place for resources where you can go and get the information you need, and a place where you can support learning and research and progress in your area.
I
want to
see the project being increased. It's not purely a learning project, it's not my own passion. It's a project that could disseminate more productive literacy practices to other countries.
Very young, and obviously that's where literacy starts. And so
thus the birth of this project that Jeff is going to walk you guys through today. So again, if you're interested in any of the background research and how all this came to be, you know, a simple search on the internet will pull up a lot of additional reading. We also have a reading list that you should have, and there are references on that as well.
I'm going to say a couple things about what you've done at the Community Library Association. They also have handouts about it. So, I just want to give you a little bit of an overview of what has been going on in Uganda and sub-Saharan Africa for the last century or two. I'm just going to read this, and I'm going to read the rest of this presentation, but I do want to read this. One of the legacies of colonialism on the African continent is the widespread illiteracy and entrenched poverty that interfere with the people's full participation in the global economy. As of 1991, 54% of all Africans were illiterate. In some African countries, the literacy rate was over 90%. Africa is also the poorest region in the world and the only major developing region with negative growth in income per capita during 1980 to 2000. In sub-Saharan Africa, the average daily wage is 74 cents. The average life expectancy is 46 years, while the average child mortality rate, that's calculated as deaths before the age of 5 per 1,000 live births, is 172.5. Improvement in the literacy rate could provide the necessary conditions for an economic renaissance in Africa through mass dissemination of information people could then use to produce goods and services in demand in other parts of Africa and overseas. The role of literacy in the functioning of the democratic process has also been noted. So, as I just read, we feel that improving literacy rates in sub-Saharan Africa, such as a country like Uganda, could ultimately result in some kind of economic boom to the people who live there. Because I'm a child researcher primarily, I wanted to take a look at how we might be able to improve literacy and develop a reading culture in the very young children who live in this particular village. The Kitigesa Library is actually part of a network of rural community libraries that have been developed in Uganda and other Eastern and Western African countries. And it's sort of a flagship community library for this kind of research. And so I wanted to develop a study of the young children. In 2009, Lee and I went over and we studied 5 to 7-year-olds. This time around, we wanted to actually conduct a sort of an intervention. We wanted to establish a particular type of a reading activity in the library. The library would be sponsoring or hosting this reading activity. And then evaluating in a pre-post kind of test experimental design in which we went over in last August to do the pre-test of this group of children, and then we're going back next August to conduct a post-test to see whether this reading intervention actually made a difference on certain domains of child development. So the storytelling, story-acting activity is the reading activity that we're assessing. This is an activity that was first developed by a woman named Vivian Haley, who developed it in Chicago in the 1980s. And it's been researched to some extent in the United States by a woman named Angeliki Nikolopoulou. Perhaps you attended her presentation at the High Child Concentration Meeting last November. She came and spoke. She's the chair of the psychology department at Lehigh University. This particular reading activity has certain features that I felt would be very attractive to encouraging narrative comprehension and social competence and emergent literacy in the group of children who are working with Uganda. We thought that they would really take to this, even though it's something very foreign to them. It involves, you can read this on your own, but the activity essentially asks children in the group to come up during a free play time and come to the librarian, and you met him, his name is Julius, he was in the documentary, and dictate a story, a made-up story, totally made-up. It could be a story they've heard before, or a story that was told to them. It doesn't matter. Just dictating a story which the librarian then writes down verbatim. Okay? So the librarian writes down and transcribes these stories from various children who come up in the course of a replay situation. Writes these down and keeps them in the notebook. And then the second part of the activity is for the children to act out these stories that they themselves had told the librarian. So basically, the librarian takes a masking tape, and develops a rectangle like this, and asks the children to sit around the rectangle. The librarian then calls up the first child who gave his or her story, and then underlines the characters in that story. So it could be a mom, a dad, a chicken, a princess, whatever it might be. And then the child, the storyteller, has to pick out among the children, the group of children in the group, the people who he or she wants to be the characters in the story. So I want, you know, Billy to be the frog, and I want Janice to be the mom, and so forth and so on. And then the librarian says, okay, let's act out the story together. So the librarian reads each line of the story, and as he's reading it, the children act out the movements of the story, act out the parameters of the story. Everybody understand the basic premise of this activity? I think it's really a novel idea, and unfortunately, our schools aren't advanced enough to implement this in their pedagogy, but I think it's brilliant.
Just a few words, we have some video clips later on that we're going to show you what the activity actually taking place. One of the things that we're very sensitive to is the fact that this particular intervention, along with some of the measures that we conducted, obviously, you know, in terms of the measures, they were more than a Western population. And so there are certainly issues that have to do with cultural sensitivity and cultural relevance. Anytime you're in an area where students just don't have, or children in this case, don't have the experience of storytelling, for instance, the concept, the idea of acting, to be foreign to these kids. So you see in the video that it takes a while to get them used to that concept of what that means to act out their own story. And we were certainly sensitive to that, something that came up again and again. This kind of activity, though, believe it or not, is much more culturally sensitive than other interventions because the stories belong to the kids. They own them, they indicate who's going to act out their stories, and so on. So in that way,
that's one reason why we selected this type of activity. The stories are very organic, and as you'll see video clips, you'll see that they're spontaneously coming from the children. Now, Eric and I acted out our own story just to give them an idea about how to go about doing this, so that they had some idea of what we were kind of looking for. But the stories themselves are going to come directly from the children's own experience, fantasy, etc. So the other point I want to make was in response to the cultural sensitivity issues related to the instruments we use. One response to that is that, you know, we're not comparing these children to a Western sample. We're actually comparing these children to each other. So we're comparing children who've been exposed to the reading activity to children who have not been exposed to the reading activity. Now, unfortunately, we were unable to randomize the assignment of these children. It's just impossible for logistical reasons as well as moral reasons. But so we will not be able to make firm conclusions based on the data that we collect next August. But you know, you do the best you can. We're hoping to see changes over time anyway in the group that's been exposed to this once a week reading activity. Julius actually the document is the one who's actually conducting the story activity over there, even as we speak. So what are the goals of storytelling, story acting? Well, we want to foster a culture of cooperation, inclusion, and collaborative learning within the library setting. The library is actually the host for this type of activity. And we wanted to promote children's acquisition of key, mutually reinforcing elements of school readiness. The three domains that we assessed in our protocol of assessments: narrative comprehension, social competence, and emergent literacy. We hypothesized that we would expect to see changes in all three of these domains as a result of exposure, weekly exposure to the storytelling, story acting activity. We expect that storytelling, story acting activity would increase children's vocabulary, language complexity, story comprehension, production, they're creating and acting in their own and other stories. In so doing, they're gaining knowledge of the power of stories. Telling stories for and with their peers and acting them out together for an audience helps children develop self-regulation, as I'll talk about in the next slide. Children are actually playing, but in their play, they're actually imposing their own rules, right? Stories have certain rules. People do certain things and not other things. So it's a rule-based, all social pretend play has rules that all the children have to follow in order to participate in the play. So they're learning how to inhibit certain behaviors and regulate their emotional states by playing certain roles, and they have to play them according to the storyline that was told by the child. This activity promotes children's abilities to understand others' perspectives. So we also thought that it might have an impact on mentalization, perspective taking, interpreting the behavior of others in the context of mental states, which is the definition of theory of mind, expressing increasingly complex and coherent stories, cooperating with other children during the dramatization of those stories, and enacting a fictional character and taking various characters' points of view. When you read, and Lita and I attended a conference last year, we heard the great Keith Oakley speak, everything was talking to the psychologist. He talked about the process of reading and how reading and the founding of the Gutenberg Press and the mass dissemination of actual reading materials actually influenced the way Western society anyway has been able to empathize with people different from the reader. So when you read a novel or you read a book, as you're reading through, the writer is actually getting you to empathize with the various characters in the story. That's actually facilitating your ability to take the perspective of another person. In your mind, you can actually do that. And that actually facilitates mentalization, I would argue, and theory of mind. So we were hoping to see changes in theory of mind over time, over and above developmental changes that you would normally expect to see in children. So play is a very important aspect of the storytelling, story acting activity. All children desire, this is an assumption that we're making, of course, all children desire to realize their wishes through fantasy or imagination. And when children engage in social pretend play, there are two interconnected components of that. There's the imaginary situation, a possible world, if you will, that a child is conveying when they're telling a story. So that's one part of it. The imagination of the child conveyed verbally to the librarian who's writing up the story. And the other part is the rules that define and create the imaginary situation. You can't have an imagination without certain rules. Not perhaps intuitively obvious, and it might seem sort of contradictory, paradoxical, but it's true. You have to have rules in order to have an imagination. And so when these different children, as you'll see in the video clip, are actually portraying characters in the child's story and walking around the stage, they are engaging in the following of certain rules. So they're learning how to inhibit themselves and conform to the rules of the story. Very important for the development of social competence as well as narrative comprehension. You can read the rest of this for yourself. Children experience stories contextualized by the actions of themselves and others. Because of play scenarios acted out, children can see more clearly how things fit or don't fit together in the scenario that they try to create only with words. So if you think of narrative activity as being placed on a continuum from completely motoric behavior acting out, right, to an abstract story that's strictly being told, you can see that that narrative comprehension can flow between these two poles of motoric acting out and verbal storytelling or verbal narrative. And what the storytelling and story acting activity does is it integrates these two poles of narrative activity and brings them together and coordinates them in ways that very few other interventions, I think, would do. The other story I wanted to tell is that a gallery who's here last November, she's conducted the storytelling, story acting activity in a number of different classrooms. And one of the little vignettes that she includes in one of her articles is that of a child who tells a story. The story is this: a frog and a princess. That's the story. There's the story, that's the story. So then it comes time for the child to pick characters and act out the story. So the teacher in this case read the story, a frog and a princess. And so the kids were standing in the stage and just standing there. The child was a frog and another child was a princess. And The storyteller, the child, said, "But they're not doing it." See, in her mind, she had a whole fantasy about, probably, I'm guessing here, with the princess kissing the frog and turning into a prince. And that was all in her head, but she hadn't conveyed it verbally. And so by seeing the story acted out, she could fill in the gaps in her mind and see, and begin to realize that there are words that need to encode the fantasy visual presentation that's in her mind. This storytelling, story acting activity actually facilitates that experience in kids. Okay, so we're actually going to show you a video clip of the dictation process in the storytelling, story acting activity. It's a little girl, Benita.
Okay. The supplemental questionnaire was a 25-item
survey, that we, while we wanted to gauge additional information on the primary caregivers, in particular about social support. So a lot of these mothers and grandmothers and the father had very little support available to them either from other family members or from this village. Poverty is very, very intense, and what we find is that families are pretty much on their own. It's a polygamous society, so husbands frequently have more than one family, which contributes overall to this, to the very low levels of social support that these families or that these mothers and these primary caregivers have access to. So we wanted to evaluate that, and we essentially just asked three questions: who can you confide in? Who would you be able to turn to in an emergency? And who would you be able to turn to help care for your family if you ended up in the hospital and had to have some kind of major surgery? Just in terms of, again, I'm going to look at this really, really quickly. We also looked at the physical health and quality of life. We also did a very, very short depression scale for the primary caregivers. Again, these were the indicators that we found in 2009 were having some impact on the children because they didn't know how, they didn't know what those pathways were. So we looked at, on a daily basis, how the primary caregivers felt, whether they experienced pain in their young lives, whether they were able to exert physical or work activities like carrying a jug of water or a pill, whether they had a job. They also told us, by use of the dark web co-op charts, which is anybody who's familiar with, these are rapid charts that caregivers or patients essentially points to. They're like smiling faces almost. So if you're feeling really, really good, you know, there's a broad smile on the face and you point to that, if you're feeling terrible, you point to the smiling face that has the frown. We didn't want to use a lot of language-based measures for the primary caregivers because they don't speak English. So this was seen as being much more culturally sensitive. This instrument has been previously used in Uganda, so that's another reason that we selected it. And then another part of assessing for depression, we used a standardized health survey, chose 9 items that we looked at, whether the person had felt nervous or down in the dumps or very, very blue and depressed for a period of time. We used that as our depression scale.
I just want to make a comment. A few slides ago, you noticed the total possession. You saw the electricity supply, television, TV, recorder, all of that. We were using an instrument that was standardized in sub-Saharan Africa, where some people do actually have electricity supply and do have those items. I can assure you that in these two villages of KTS and Dilemma, we assessed 79 children and mothers. One family had electricity, and
they had one solar panel.
They had a solar panel installed on the roof, which gave them like enough electricity for a light bulb. So there was no television, there was no TV recorder. I just want to make that clear. So cumulative social protection risk. These are some of the indices of risk that have been previously supported in the literature. As I mentioned, Jay Belsky had developed a similar social contextual risk variable. And so we essentially added all these variables together to construct one measure or index of risk. And what we found actually is that the measure of risk did not correlate with any of the outcome measures. Interestingly, I think the reason possibly is that there was an attenuation of range, which means that the range of scores in our sample was so small because everybody is poor. There's no, really very little disparity of income. In this society, there's a massive disparity of income. You've got the Warren Buffetts of the world, and then you've got the homeless, you know, a few blocks away from each other. Over there, there's really no, very little any disparity in income or socioeconomic level. So it'd be hard to get significant findings on this variable. So very quickly, the first domain of children's development that we assessed was narrative comprehension. We wanted to get a baseline on their narrative comprehension, and so we assessed, we try to assess, for oral retelling, picture sequence task, single picture task, which is sort of like a CAT or a TAT, and a spontaneous story task. And what we found, I'll just give you the short answer to this question, we did totally wrong. None of these kids could do any of this. And I think one reason is that these children don't have the ability to tell narratives in a decontextualized fashion. Remember, I talked about the poles between totally acting out narrative and telling us, you know, the storytelling using words, and then everything along the continuum. These particular tasks fall more on the verbal mediated end of the pole of narrative activity. And these children just don't have that capability. And so, interestingly, the attachment story completion task, which requires some narrative comprehension, but which involves actually acting out dolls, they did much better on than on these tasks. So after the first two or three children, we decided to drop these instruments from the protocol because we weren't just getting anything out of them. Children's social competence was a big area that we assessed. We administered five theory of mind tasks, a recognition of emotion task, which is kind of like a Peabody for emotions. If you're familiar with the ABBT, there's four facial expressions different, and you give them a word like, show me happy. And they had to point to the facial expression that matches happy or embarrassed. And they get increasingly difficult. So that's recognition of emotion concepts. A play interview, how well did they engage in pretend play, symbolic play. There's a day-night task and happening test. These are both tasks that assess inhibitory control. So we tell the child, okay, we show them a picture of nighttime, and we say they have to say day. And we show a picture, we come around their mind, okay? We show them a picture of the sun in daytime, and we tell them to say night. And so we show these pictures, and they have to say either day or night, depending upon the opposite of what they would normally say. So they have to inhibit their initial response and say a non-dominant response. And with the tapping test, it's similar, it's motoric and auditory. So if I tap twice, the child has to tap once. If I tap once, the child has to tap twice. So the knee-jerk or reflexive response would be to tap exactly the way I tap, to imitate me. They can't do that. They can inhibit that initial response and do the opposite. So two taps is one tap, one tap is two taps. And then the attachment story completion task is a semi-structured interview with five story stems. The child is presented with a series of story stems using a family of dolls. They had to complete the story stem with using the family of dolls, and from that information, we can then categorize these children into one of four action categories: secure, anxious avoidant, anxious resistant, or disorganized. And actually, my coding team is going to be coding the attachment story completion task, not for attachment, but for symbolic play. So that we have a measure of their pretend play in a situation in which they did better. It's more contextualized, they're actually acting out in addition to telling a story. We have some video clips for you. The first is the theory of mind task. This is a particular task that involves a tea box and something inside the tea box.
Yeah.
When John is eating,
Who's hitting mommy?
Come on, you're fine.
Aren't you sitting down?
The monster is going to be buried in Nambas Hay.
The monster is going to be buried in Nambas Hay. Okay, that is an extremely atypical response for an American sample or a Ugandan sample, doesn't matter. But I just wanted to give you a sense of the kind of richness, I mean, this is a very rich story, you have to give me that, that can be gleaned from administering the Academy's work that we should have. And in spite of the fact that, you know, this would obviously be classified disorganized in the attachment category system, classification system, nevertheless, there was symbolic play going on there. And my coding team is going to be coding this story. So while I was doing all this work, I want to show you what Eric was doing. Getting back to the third index that we assessed, we looked at children's emergent literacy, and we had two instruments that we used to assess emergent literacy. One was the Kalifi picture book paper test. This is a test that was developed by a researcher in Uganda, and it's a recyclable paper test. It works just like a Peabody. Four pictures. You say the word, and the child has to point to the picture that depicts the word that you just said. And all the pictures are very culturally appropriate, like firewood is one of the pictures. And so they just point to the firewood. Things that the child is actually very familiar with in his or her environment. Then we have the Bracken basic concept scale. This instrument did all the heavy lifting. It's like a Wilcox Johnson for preschoolers. The best way I can describe it. And these are the five different areas that were assessed using the Bracken. Their colors, their letters, their numbers and counting, sizes and comparisons, and then shapes. So we had them do these five subtests. And we use that in this particular pretest study as the outcome there, the Bracken.
Just one really quick item about the picture vocabulary test. In 2009, we did use the Peabody. And we tried. The Peabody contained images like an Eskimo, an igloo, and I remember the penguin. And these children had absolutely no concept of what those images were. And it was at that time that we began to understand that we needed to use measures again that were beyond being culturally sensitive. These measures, and as far as we could control that, using measures that had been created. This population, so we don't
So we collected data on 79 children and caregivers, and these are just some of the descriptive statistics. You'll see that the average, I'll just point out a couple of them here. I'm going to go through these kind of quickly. The mean age was about 4 years, 8 months, and we accepted children from age 3 to 5, five being 5 years, 10 months, actually, is the maximum. And then the minimum was 3 years, 0 months. I think it's probably all in one. Oh, yeah, and gender, the mean percentage was, or the percentage was 51% male. So pretty evenly balanced, that's actually not true in specific groups. Okay, so then with the descriptive statistics by group, we had 28 kids in the future storytelling, story acting group, 30 kids in the comparison group. These are kids and guests of children who are not, who do not belong to the library, hence will not be belonging to, will be not participating in the storytelling, story acting activity. And then a comparison group to the comparison group and the experimental group of dilemma children. These are children who had no access or exposure to a library at all. And as you can see on certain indices, unfortunately age was significant, so we'll have to control for age when we do the post-test analysis of the data, as well as gender. There were many more males for some reason in the kidney gets a comparison group in the other two groups. But down here is what I want to show you. Theory of mind, tapping test, and receptive vocabulary. Either the kidney gets a reading group or both the kidney gets a reading group and the comparison group were greater than the dilemma group. Now, what argument or what explanation for that is that the children in kidney gets a have a library in their community. And so the benefits that the caregivers have received from, by virtue of the library being in their community, has already trickled down and started to affect the abilities of the children in certain domains that we assess. Versus the dilemma kids whose parents have had no access to reading materials or any kind of a library at all. Most of them, I don't think, did any of them know how to read the caregivers? So I just wanted to show you those descriptive statistics by group. Then we've got zero-order correlations among the variables. Just wanted to show you down here the school readiness skills. We had correlations with child age, which we would expect, pretend play, recognition of emotion, where they had a point to the face that corresponded to the emotion that we communicated to them verbally, theory of mind, and then tapping test, and obviously receptive vocabulary. So a lot of these other indices correlated very positively with school readiness skills, which we would expect. So emotional complexity and the understanding of emotional life in oneself and others, and understanding the mind of the other, actually is correlated with level of school readiness as measured by the bracket, you know, color, shapes, letters, comparisons and sizes. There are relationships there. So emotional health is obviously related to school achievement, preschool achievement. So then I took the variables that were positively correlated, significantly correlated with school readiness skills as measured by the bracket, put them in a multiple regression equation, and lo and behold, it was a very significant prediction, squared multiple R of 0.36. But look at this, the only variable that predicted school readiness after controlling for all the other variables in the equation was the tapping test. Very interesting. And so I was thinking about why the tapping test might be related after controlling for everything else while the others aren't. And one idea that I had was that the tapping test actually assesses motoric inhibition of behavior. It's not really not verbally mediated at all. You can actually, Eric and I actually administered this task with almost no verbal instruction at all. It's merely watching and listening. And they were able to do that. But maybe some of the tasks were a lot more difficult. something verbally mediated, and we're actually going through a translator, so they're hearing everything secondhand. We're not actually able to speak Lunanga, unfortunately. So that was interesting to find. Then, you know me, I like mediation models, so I had to test a mediation model, right? So I found that, I learned that depression on the SF-36, that was the measure that Delia had talked about, there were 9 items. One of those items was, I have been a happy person within the past 4 weeks. That variable was correlated with both school readiness skills composite score on the Bracken and theory of mind. So I want to see whether maybe theory of mind might have mediated the relationship between the depression item and school readiness skills. And lo and behold, as you can see here, depression becomes non-significant in step 2, and theory of mind is very significant. And the F change is significant as well. So there was a mediational model that was supported here. So what does that mean exactly? Well, depression was actually positively correlated with theory of mind. You wouldn't expect that, right? You would think the less depressed the mother is, the more available she is to the child, and the freer she is to pick up on the child's signals, which would cultivate theory of mind. What I think might be going on here is that this is a self-report measure, the depression measure, was self-report, and so mothers who were depressed might have been in the interest of social desirability and maybe interpersonal desirability, deny their depressive feelings. So those mothers who are more willing to acknowledge their feelings of depression were probably more willing to acknowledge a range, emotional range, in their children, which would allow the children to develop their own theory of mind independent of their mothers. Very good. Alternative explanation of that. I don't know if you want to pass on that or. Gary and I talked about this particular issue, what this might mean. But we thought this very interesting. Next slide. However, when we controlled for age, the children's age, and the receptive vocabulary score, actually the mediational model actually disappears. So we're not sure whether this is a real finding or whether it's spurious based on receptive vocabulary in the child's age. So summary of findings. Assessment instruments could be culturally biased. We couldn't use any of the narrative comprehension instruments. We had to drop those. Telling a story based on pictorial stimuli is an unfamiliar process to the children because they are unaware that a pictorial symbol carries a meaning that can be expressed verbally in the construction of the story. Children's memories are not processing information in a linear manner required of understanding the text. They don't have that practice, that facility. These children seem to perform better in highly structured tasks that contextualize meanings with actions. That's why I think the storytelling, story acting activity is perfect for this population, because they can actually see a verbally told story acted out at the same time and get a better comprehension of that narrative. Cumulative social contextualism would not predict school readiness skills, perhaps because of the attenuation range I talked about. Non-verbally mediated self-regulation, that's the tapping test, predictive readiness skills, school readiness skills after controlling for receptive vocabulary, and children's theory of mind mediated the relation between caregiver depression and school readiness skills.
So just in terms of the next steps, we definitely talked about this, we want to return next August to figure out what's been happening over the course of this year during which kind of the intervention has been going on. And just in closing, really, the socio-cultural implications of this project, so why are we doing this? Essentially, in the documentary, Dr. Kate Perry said that the vision at the end of the day is a library and a village. That's it in a nutshell. That's what we're aiming for. So the point of all this is demonstrating that these rural village libraries, which are very small, this library is more highly developed than libraries that you'll find in other kinds of villages. But the idea is to take this model, to replicate it. In order to do that, you really need to have data and evidence that is doing what you think it should be doing in part. And we think that one of the things that it should be doing is contributing to the development of a reading culture, but also helping to prepare the very youngest library users for school, so that when they enter school, they're at the level that we hope would have them be successful as they continue on through elementary, primary, and secondary school. So we're looking at programmatic development, we're looking at being able to target library programs that help the primary caregivers. So in the areas that we determine that there are issues related to the primary caregivers and their connection with their children, is there a way that the library can become instrumental in helping these primary caregivers to work with their children and to help them learn how to read and so on. Reading culture is a key for economic development, and we also obviously want to be able to continue to measure the children's progress and the impact of the library on the community. So over time, this is something that we hope to continue to look at.
You know, I think presenting attachment data, and the reason for that is that I no longer care about attachment. No, it takes some time to code attachment data, and I hire somebody to do it, and so I won't be able to present those data. But we're going to continue to collect attachment data in August. And if anybody's interested in participating in this research, maybe getting a dissertation idea out of these data, you're welcome to contact me or contact Lolita about it. We have tons of data now that are just waiting for somebody to analyze and write up. So there are dissertation possibilities here. There are also possibilities of joining us in Uganda in 2013 and beyond. And these are the unsung and sung soldiers of this project. I just want to give a shout out to my students, many of whom are here. Caregiver and child transcription right here, right there. They're the backbone of this operation. And I don't know if Tina Lowe could make it today, but Tina is the American Project Coordinator, and she was instrumental in pulling everything together and kind of organizing things. Our Ugandan Project Coordinator, Julia Centumi, who saw the documentary, was very pivotal in organizing things overseas for us, and continues to lead the storytelling, story acting activity. Paul Forbesell actually provided some funding for Eric to go to Uganda, so we want to thank him in particular as well for being helpful in that regard. Any questions? That's the team. Anything more?
Yeah, we're trying to figure out the video.